Chapter 14. Changes. The sisters who had said there was almost as much to learn after gaining the shawl as before were proven right in short order. Moiraine and Swan had learned the complexities of White Tower customs as accepted, especially which ones had been in existence so long they had the force of law and the penalties for violating them. Now Rafella and others spent hours instructing them in the long list of Blue Aja customs, accreted over 3,000 years. Swan actually retained most of what Rafella had told them during their first walk to the Blue Quarters, and Moiraine had to work hard to catch up. It would have been a shame to gain a penance for something so trivial as wearing red inside the tower. Red gems were allowed, firedrops or rubies or garnets, but the color was forbidden in clothing, a matter of some long-standing animosity between the blue and the red, so old no one was actually certain what had begun it or when. Blue and red opposed each other as a matter of course, at times bringing the hall to a near standstill. The very idea of enmity between Ajahs startled her, yet there were other oppositions. While the green and the blue had seen few breaks in their accord for several centuries, the situation was far different regarding other Ajahs. At the moment there was a slight strain with the white, for reasons known only to the white, and something more tense with the yellow, with sisters of each accusing sisters of the other of interfering with their actions in Altara some 100 years past. Strong custom forbade interference with another sister, a custom that provided the sole release from the customary deference, outside the tower at least. And then there were the permutations. For example, the brown supported the white against the blue, but supported the blue against the yellow. For the time being, anyway. These things could last for centuries, or shift in the blink of an eye. It also was necessary to learn what antagonisms and rivalries existed between other Ajahs, too, where they were known. Each was a snare lying in wait for an unwary step or a careless word. Light, the tangle of it all, made Desdemar child's play. Swan heard her recitations every night, just as they had as novice and accepted, and she heard Swan's. Though there hardly seemed a point, Swan never made any mistakes. They found themselves studying the power again, with Lelaine and Natasia and Anaya and others taking turns, learning the warder bond and other weaves not trusted to accepted, including a few known only to the blue. Moiraine found that very interesting. If the blue included weaves among their Aja secrets, surely the other Ajas did as well. And if the Ajas, perhaps individual sisters. After all, she had had one, her first learned, before coming to Tarvalen, and had carefully concealed it from the sisters. They had been aware the spark was already ignited in her, but she told them only about lighting candles and making a ball of light to find her way in the dark. No one lived in the Sun Palace without learning to keep secrets. Did Swan have any secret weaves? It was not the sort of question you could ask your closest friend. Although they knew enough now of Sidar to learn quickly, there simply was too much for a day or a week. At least Moiraine could not do it. The method of ignoring heat or cold turned out to be a trick of mental concentration, simple enough once you knew how, or so Natasia pronounced. "The mind must be as still as an unruffled pond throughout," she said pedantically, just as she lectured in the classroom. They were in her rooms, where almost every flat surface was covered with figurines and small carvings and painted miniatures. These lessons always took place in the teacher's rooms. "Focusing on a point behind your navel in the center of your body, you begin to breathe at an unvarying pace, but not as normally. Each inhalation must take exactly the same length of time, and each exhalation, and between, for that same space, you do not breathe. In time, that will come quite naturally. Breathing so, focused so, soon your mind becomes detached from the outer world, no longer acknowledging heat or cold. You might walk naked in a blizzard or across a desert without shivering or sweating." Taking a sip of tea, Natasia laughed, her dark, tilted eyes twinkling. "Frostbite and sunburn would still present difficulties after a time. Only the mind is truly distanced, the body much less so. Simple, perhaps, yet for above a week Moiraine's focus might slip at any time, sitting at supper or walking down a corridor, and she would let out a gasp as the cold suddenly rushed in and bit down three times as hard as before she began the meditation. In public, all that huffing attracted stares from other sisters. She very much feared she was gaining a reputation as a dreamer, and as a constant blusher. It was hardly to be borne. Needless to say, Swan picked up the trick straight away and never shivered again that Moiraine saw. The Feast of Lights came to mark the turning of the year, and for 2 days every window in Tar Valon shone brightly from twilight till dawn. In the tower, servants entered chambers that had been unused for centuries to light lamps and make sure they burned the whole 2 days. It was a joyous celebration, with processions of citizens carrying lamps through the night-cloaked streets, and merry gatherings that frequently lasted until sunrise in even the poorest homes. But it filled Moiraine with sadness. Chambers unused for centuries. The White Tower was dwindling, and she could not see what was to be done about it. But then, if women who had worn the shawl 200 years or more could find no solution, why should she be able to? Many sisters received ornately inscribed invitations to balls during the feast, and quite a number accepted. Aes Sedai could like dancing as well as any other woman. Moiraine got invitations, too, from Cairienan nobles of 24 houses, and almost as many merchants wealthy enough to rub shoulders with the nobility. Only the hall's plans for her could have placed so many powerful Cairienan in the city at one time. She tossed the stiff white cards into the fireplace, unanswered. A dangerous move in Des de Mar, with no way to tell how it might be interpreted, but she was not playing the game of houses. She was hiding. Surprisingly, their first dresses were delivered early on the first day of the feast. Either Tamora was eager for her gratuity, or, more likely, she thought they would want the garments for feast day festivities. She came with two of her assistants to see whether any adjustments were necessary, but none were. Tamora was excellent at what she did. Moiraine had been right, though. The darkest of her six was in a hue little deeper than sky blue, and only two were embroidered, which meant nearly everything else would be. She would have to keep on wearing the woolens the Aja had given her a while longer. At least all of her riding dresses would be dark. Even Tamora could not ask for a riding dress in too light a hue. Swan's dresses, only one divided for riding, displayed all the elegance Tamora was capable of, making them suitable for a palace despite being wool, but they emphasized her bosom and hips quite strongly. Swan affected not to notice, or perhaps did not. She really cared very little about clothing. Some things were not easy for Swan, either. She returned from Satalia's apartments with a face that grew stiffer by the day. Every day she became more prickly and irritable, but she refused to reveal what the problem was, and even snapped at Moiraine when she persisted in asking. That was worrying. She could count on the fingers of one hand with fingers left over the times Swan had gotten angry with her in 6 years. The day Tamora delivered the dresses, however, Swan joined her for tea in her rooms before going down to supper, but instead of taking a cup, she flung herself down in a leaf-carved armchair and folded her arms angrily beneath her breasts. Her face was anything but stiff, and her eyes were blue fire. "That bloody fangfish of a woman will be the bloody death of me yet!" she growled. That half a week had undone every scrap of the sister's hard work with her language. "Fish guts! She expects me to jump like a spawning red-tail. I never jumped so fast when I was a—" She gave a strangled grunt, and her eyes popped as the first oath clamped down. Coughing, her face turning pale, she pounded a fist on her chest. Moiraine hastily poured a cup of tea, but it was minutes before Swan could drink. Her mind must have been racing for her to come that close. "Well, not when I was accepted, anyway," she muttered once she could speak again. "From the moment I arrive, it's find this swan and do that swan, and aren't you finished yet, swan?" Satalia snaps her fingers and bloody well expects me to jump. that is how things are," Moiraine said judiciously. The situation could have been much worse, but Swan's mind apparently had changed on that point, and she did not want to start an argument. "It will not last forever, and only a handful of sisters stand so high above us."
"That's easy for you to say," Swan grumbled. "You don't have bloody Satalia snapping her fingers at you."
That was true, yet it hardly meant her task was easy. The new lessons left her little free time, but she had hoped distributing the bounty would allow her to search among the camps that still remained. Instead, for 2 or 3 hours each morning, she sat in a windowless room on the 8th level of the tower, just large enough for a plain writing table and 2 straight-backed chairs. Mirrored stand lamps of unadorned brass stood in the 4 corners, giving a good and very necessary light. Lacking them, the chamber would have been twilight dark at noon. Normally a senior clerk sat there, but whoever that was, she or he had left no imprint on the room at all. Only inkwell, pen tray, sand jar, and a small white bowl of alcohol for cleaning the pens sat on the table, and the pale stone walls were bare. The considerably larger outer room was crowded by rows of high, narrow writing desks and tall stools, but as soon as she arrived, the clerks formed a line that stretched from her writing table and nearly circled their own room, bringing her lists of women who had received the bounty and reports on arrangements to send the money to women who had already left. The number of those reports was distressing. Few camps remained, and the last were melting away like frost in sunlight. None of the clerks used her second chair, only stood respectfully while she read each page and signed her approval at the bottom, then curtsied or bowed and made way for the next without a word. Very quickly she began to think it really might be possible to die of boredom. She tried to make them arrange the distribution faster. The tower's vast resources could have seen to it in a week, surely. The tower held hundreds more clerks. But clerks worked at their own pace. They even seemed to slow down after her suggestion of speed. She considered begging Tamra to release her from the task, but why put herself to useless effort? What better way to keep her shackled in Tar Valon until the Hall's schemes came to fruition? Boredom and frustration. Still, she had her plan. That helped, a bit. Slowly, a conviction settled in her. If worse came to worst, she would run, whatever penance that earned her. Any penance lay in the future, and must end eventually. The Sun Throne would be a sentence for life. The day after the Feast of Lights, Elid was summoned to her testing, though Moiraine only heard of it after. The beautiful accepted who wanted to become a Green failed to come out of the Turangreal. There was no announcement. The White Tower never flaunted its failures, and a woman dying in her test was counted a great failure on the Tower's part. Elid simply disappeared, and her belongings were taken away. There was a day of mourning, however, and Moiraine wore white ribbons in her hair and tied a long lace-edged white silk kerchief around each arm so they dangled to her wrists. She had never liked Elid, but the woman deserved her grief. Not every sister who was strong enough to make them jump showed any desire to do so. Elida avoided them, or at least they did not see her again before hearing she had left to return to Andor. Even so, learning she was gone was a relief. She stood as high as they would one day, and could have made their lives a misery almost as badly as she had when they were novice and accepted. Perhaps worse. The petty errands novice and accepted took as expected would have been near a penance for them as Aes Sedai. Perhaps more than near. Lilaine, who stood as high as Elida and was a sitter to boot, had them to tea several times to ease the strain of the first weeks, as she put it. Swan got on very well with her, though she made Moiraine a little nervous with that penetrating gaze. It always seemed that Lilaine knew more of you than she revealed, that you had no secrets with her. But then Swan appeared unable to understand Moiraine's liking for Anaya. It was not the healing. Anaya was warm and open, and made you feel that all would come out well in the end. Almost any conversation with Anaya turned out comforting. Moiraine thought that in time she might become as close a friend as Lyanna, if not so close as Swan. That friendship with Liana took up right where it had left off, for her and Swan both, and brought with it Adina Canford, a plump blue-eyed woman with short-cut black hair who displayed not a hint of arrogance, despite being Andoran. Of course, she was not very strong in the power. It really was becoming second nature to consider that. They renewed acquaintance with sisters of other Ajahs who had been accepted with them, and found that in some cases friendship revived within a few words, and in others had shrunk to mere amity, while a few had grown too accustomed to the gap between Aes Sedai and accepted to close it again, now they wore the shawl too. It was enough. Friends lightened many burdens, even those they did not know of. Friends or no friends, though, the days passed with glacial slowness. Malin finally departed the tower, and then Kareen, followed in turn by Aisha, Ludis, and Valera. But Moiraine's relief that the search was underway at last was tempered by frustration at being kept out of it. Swan began to grow interested in her job, to the point where her complaints started to seem more for the form of the thing. She headed off to Satalia's rooms earlier than need be, and often remained until the second or third sitting of supper. Moiraine had no such buffer. Her nightmares continued, of the babe in the snow and the faceless man and the sun throne, although not as frequently, save the last. Ever as bad, though. She banished most of the lace and ruffles from her rooms, which required only a visit to a cushion maker and a small wait for their alteration by twos and threes. Not all, because of Anaya's obvious, if silent, disappointment at seeing them go, so her bed remained an ocean of froth that made Swan giggle with delight. But she spent more time in her other rooms, so the bed it had to be. After numerous efforts, she managed to bake a pie without burning it black, but Aeldra took one bite and turned pale green. Swan produced a fish pie that the gray-haired sister declared quite tasty, only within the hour she was running for the privy and required healing. No one accused them of doing anything deliberate, which they had not, but Anaya and Chiron thought it an excellent repayment for greediness. Only a week after Elid, on High Chasseline, Shiriam was tested and passed. Technically, Swan was the newest blue by a hair, but Satalia refused to lose her services for even a few hours, so it was Moiraine who laid the shawl on the fire-haired Saldaean's shoulders when she chose the blue the following day, and escorted her beaming back to the blue quarters for the welcome, where Swan managed to nip in for the sixth kiss. Shiriam was a very good cook, and loved to bake. It was the day of reflection in Cairhien, yet Moiraine could not manage to dwell on her sins and faults. She and Swan had regained a friend they had feared might be lost for a year. Swan even suggested bringing Shiriam into their search, and talking her out of it required hours. It was not that Moiraine feared Shiriam would expose them to Tamra, but Shiriam had been one of the biggest gossips in the Accepted's quarters. She never told what she promised to keep hidden, yet she would be unable to resist giving hints of such a juicy secret, hints that she had a secret, as Swan should have known very well. Let others know you possessed a secret, and some would work to learn it. That was a fact of nature. Sometimes Swan did not know the meaning of caution. Sometimes? No, never. Sisters began to talk of a resurgence in the tower with so many passing for the shawl in so short a time, and perhaps another one or two who might very soon. By custom, none spoke of Elid, but Moiraine thought of her. One woman dead and three raised to the shawl in the space of 2 weeks, but the only novice to test for accepted in that time had failed and been sent away, and not one name was added to the novice book, while above 20 novices too weak ever to reach the shawl were put out. Those chambers would remain unused for centuries more at this rate, until they were all unused. Swan tried to soothe her, but how could she be happy when the White Tower was destined to become a monument to the dead? 3 days later, Moiraine wished she had spent the day of reflection properly. She was not superstitious, but failure to do so always brought ill luck to someone you cared for, so it was said.
She was at the second sitting of breakfast, slowly eating her porridge and fretting over the boredom of torture by clerk to come, when Rima Galfrey glided into the dining room. Slim and elegant in yellow-slashed green, much of a height with Moiraine, she was not one of those Moiraine needed to defer to, but she had a regal bearing, accentuated by the rubies in her hair like a crown, and a haughty cast, typical of yellows, to her face. Startlingly, she wove air and fire to make her voice clearly audible in every corner of the dining hall. Last night, Tamra Ospenya, the Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalan, the Armerlin Seat, died in her sleep. May the light shine on her soul. Her voice was perfectly self-possessed, as though she had announced it would rain that day, and she waited only long enough to run a cool eye over the room to make sure her words had been absorbed before leaving. A buzz of talk started up immediately at the other tables, but Moiraine sat stunned. Aes Sedai died before their time as often as anyone else, and sisters did not grow feeble with the years. Death came in apparent full good health, yet this was so unexpected that she felt hit on the head by a hammer. The light illumined Tamra's soul, she prayed silently. The light illumine her soul, surely it would. What would happen to the search for the boy child now? Nothing, of course. Tamra's chosen searchers knew their task. They would inform the new Armerlin of their task. Perhaps the new Armerlin would release her from her own labor, if she got to the woman before the hall informed her of their scheme. Self-disgust immediately stabbed her heart, and she pushed the bowl of porridge away, all appetite gone. A woman she admired with all her soul had died, and she thought of advantage in it. Desdemar truly was ingrained in her bones, and maybe all the darkness of the Damodreds. She very nearly asked Marian for a penance, but the mistress of novices might give her something that would hold her in Tarvalan longer. Considering that just added to her guilt. So she set her own penance. Only one dress she owned came close to the white of grieving, the blue so pale it seemed more white tinged with blue, and she put that on for Tamra's funeral rites. Tamura had embroidered the garment front and back and sleeves with a fine, intricate blue mesh that looked innocent enough until she actually donned the dress. Then it seemed as blatant as what the seamstress herself had worn. No, not seemed, it was. She very nearly wept after examining herself in the stand mirror. Swan blinked at the sight of her in the corridor outside their rooms.
"Are you sure you want to wear that?"
She sounded half strangled. Long white ribbons were tied in her hair, and longer tied around her arms. The passing sisters all wore variations of the same. Aes Sedai never put on full mourning except for whites, who did not consider it so. "Sometimes a penance is required," Moiraine replied, deliberately moving her shawl down into the crooks of her elbows, and Swan asked no more. There were questions one asked and questions one did not. That was strong custom and friendship. Wearing their shawls, every sister residing in the tower gathered at a secluded clearing in a woody part of the tower grounds, where Tamra's body lay on a bier, sewn into a simple blue shroud. The morning air was more than brisk. Moiraine was aware of that, despite feeling no urge to shiver, and even the surrounding oaks were still leafless beneath a gray sky, their thick twisted limbs suitable framing for a funeral. Moiraine's garment earned more than a few raised eyebrows, but the sister's disapproval was part of her penance. Mortification of the spirit was always the hardest to endure. Strangely, the whites all wore glossy black ribbons, yet it must have been an Aja custom, for it garnered no frowns or stares from the other sisters. They must have seen it before. Any who wished were allowed to speak a prayer or a few words in memory, and most did. Only the sitters spoke among the reds, and then in very few words, but perhaps that was custom as well. Moiraine made herself go forward and stand before the bier, shawl loosely draped, exposing herself, knowing she would be the focus of every eye, the hardest to bear. May the light illumine Tamra's soul brightly as she deserved, and may she shelter in the Creator's hand until her rebirth. The light send her a radiant rebirth. I cannot think of any woman I admired more than Tamra. I admire her and honor her still. I always will. Tears welled in her eyes, and not from the humiliation that stabbed her like long thorns. She had never really known Tamra. Novices and accepted never really knew sisters, much less the Ammerlin seat. But oh, light, she would miss her. According to Tamra's wishes, her body was consumed by flows of fire, and her ashes scattered across the grounds of the White Tower by the sisters of the Aja she had been raised from, the Aja to which she had returned in death. Moiraine was not alone in weeping. Aes Sedai's serenity could not armor against all things. The rest of the day she wore that shaming dress, and that night burned it. She would never have been able to look at it again without remembering. Until a new Ammerlin was raised, the Hall of the Tower reigned over the tower, but there were increasingly strict measures in the law to ensure they did not dally too long, and by the evening after Tamra's funeral, Sierin Vayu had been raised from the grey. An Ammerlin was supposed to grant indulgences and relief from penances on the day she assumed the stole and the staff. None came from Sierin, and in the space of half a week, every last male clerk in the tower had been dismissed without a character, supposedly for flirting with novices or accepted, or for inappropriate looks and glances, which could have meant anything. Even men so old their grandchildren had children went, and some who had no liking for women at all. No one commented on it, however. No one dared, not where it might come to Sierin's ears. Three sisters were exiled from Tarvalen for a year, and twice Moiraine was forced to join the others in the traitor's court to watch an Aes Sedai stripped and stretched tight on the triangle, then birched till she howled. A ward that formed a shimmering grey dome over the stone-paved court held in the shrieks till they seemed to crowd in on Moiraine, stifling thought, stifling breath. For the first time in a week she lost focus and shivered in the cold. And not only from the cold. She feared those screams would ring in her ears for a very long time, waking or sleeping. Sierin watched and listened with utter calm. A new Ammerlin chose her own keeper, of course, and could order a new mistress of novices if she wished. Sierin had done both. Oddly, Amira, the stocky woman whose long beaded braids flailed as she worked the birch with a will, was a red, and so was the new keeper, Duhara. Neither law nor custom demanded that either keeper or mistress of novices be of the Ammerlin's former Aja, yet it was expected. But then, whispers told of considerable surprise when Sierin had chosen the grey over the red. Moiraine did not think any of Tamra's searchers would tell Sierin of the hunt for the boy child. On the day after the second birching, she presented herself in the anteroom to the Ammerlin's study, where Duhara sat rigidly upright behind her writing table with a red stole a hand wide draped around her neck. Her dark dress was so slashed with scarlet it might as well have been all scarlet. A Damani, Duhara was slim and beautiful despite being near a hand and a half taller than she, but the woman's full lips had a meanness about them, and her eyes searched for fault. Moiraine reminded herself that without the keeper's stole, Duhara would have had to jump when she snapped her fingers, should she have chosen to. As she opened her mouth, the door to the Ammerlin study banged open and Sierin strode out with a paper in her hand.
"Duhara, I need you to... Now what do you want?"
That last was barked at Moiraine, who curtsied promptly and as deeply as she had as a novice, kissing the great serpent ring on the Ammerlin's right hand before rising. That ring was Sierin's only display of jewelry. Her seven-striped stole was half the width of Duhara's stole, and her dark grey silks were simply cut. Quite plump, her round face appeared to have been constructed for jolliness, but she wore implacable grimness as though it had been carved there. Moiraine could almost look her straight in the eyes. Hard eyes. Her mouth felt dry, and she fought not to shiver in a cold that suddenly seemed worse than the heart of winter, but quick calming exercises failed to produce the composure necessary. She had learned a great deal about Sierin from the whispers about the new Ammerlin. One fact struck deep, right that moment like a sharp knife. To Sierran, her own view of the law was the law, and without a shred of mercy to be found in it, or in her. "Mother, I ask to be relieved of my duties regarding the bounty." Her voice was steady, thank the light. "The clerks are carrying out the task as quickly as they can, but making them stand in line each day for a sister to approve what they have done only robs them of hours they could be working."
Sierran pursed her mouth as though she had bitten a sour persimmon. "I'd stop that fool bounty entirely if it wouldn't put the tower in bad odor. A ridiculous waste of coin. Very well. The clerks may send their papers to another for signature. A brown, perhaps. They like that sort of thing."
Moiraine's heart soared before the Ammerlin added,
"You will remain in Tarvalin, of course. As you know, we will have need of you soon."
"As you say, mother," Moiraine replied, heart sinking into her stomach, down to her ankles after that brief flight. Offering another deep curtsy, she kissed the Ammerlin's ring once again. With a woman like Sierran, best to take no chances.
Swan was waiting in her rooms when she returned. Her friend leaned forward expectantly and looked a question.
"I am free of the bounty, but I am ordered to remain in Tarvalin."
"As you know, we will have need of you soon."
She thought that a fine mimicry of Sierran's voice, if a bit streaked with bitterness.
"Fish guts," Swan muttered, leaning back. "What will you do now?"
"I am going for a ride. You know where I will be, in what order."
Swan's breath caught.
"The light protect you," she said after a moment.
There was no point in waiting, so Moiraine changed into a riding dress, with Swan's help to make the changing faster. The dress was a suitably dark blue, with a few leafy silver vines climbing the sleeves to encircle the high neck. All of her darkest garments were embroidered, but she had begun to think a little needlework might not be so bad. Leaving her shawl folded in the tall wardrobe, she took out a cloak lined with black fox and tucked her hairbrush and comb into one of the small pockets the cloakmaker had sewn inside and her sewing kit into the other. Gathering her riding gloves, she gave Swan a hug and hurried out. Long goodbyes would have turned to tears, and she could not risk that. Sisters in the corridor glanced at her as she passed, but most seemed intent on their own affairs, though Chiron and Shirion both said it seemed a cool day for a ride. Only Edith said more, stopping her with a half-raised hand, eyeing her in a way that seemed all too like Lilaine.
"Ruined farms and villages will hardly make for a refreshing outing, I fear," the white-haired sitter murmured.
"Sierran has ordered me to remain in Tarvalin," Moiraine replied, her face a perfect Aes Sedai mask. "And I think she might see crossing one of the bridges for a few hours as disobedience."
Edith's mouth tightened for an instant, so briefly it might have been Moiraine's imagination. Clearly she had read Sierran's revelation of the plans in that response, and she was displeased.
"The Ammerlin can be fearsome toward anyone who goes against her wishes in the smallest way, Moiraine."
Moiraine almost smiled.
Light.
The woman had given her a chance to say it straight out. Well, nearly straight. A suitable Aes Sedai answer.
"As well I do not intend to cross a bridge, then. I have no wish to be birched."
In the west stable she had Arrow saddled, without saddlebags. There was no need for them for a ride in the city, and no matter what she had told Edith, the sitter might send someone to check. Moiraine would have. With luck, no one would suspect anything before nightfall. Her first stop was Mistress Dormila's, where the banker had a number of letter of rights ready in various amounts, and 4 fat leather purses containing 200 crowns in gold and silver between them. The coin would sustain Moiraine for some time. The letters of rights were for after the coin was gone and for emergencies. Once she used one, she would need to move fast. The tower's eyes and ears would be looking for her, and no matter how discreet bankers were, the tower generally learned what it wanted to learn. Mistress Dormila asked no questions, of course, but on learning that Moiraine was alone, she offered 4 of her footmen as escort, and Moiraine accepted. She had no fear of footpads, who were few in Tarvalin and easily handled in any event, but if anyone did think of robbery,
Better they were frightened off by a bodyguard than chased away with the power. That would attract attention. Wealthy women often rode with bodyguards, even in Tarvalin. The men who walked in a box around Arrow as she departed the bankers might have been called footmen, but though they wore plain gray coats, they were muscular men who looked accustomed to the swords hanging from their belts. Doubtless they were the footmen who had overcome Master Gorthanas, or whatever his true name was. They, or men like them. Banks always had guards, though never called that. At Tamura's shop, she sent two of the men with coin to purchase a travel trunk and hire a pair of porters, then changed into one of the riding dresses that marked her as a minor Kyrianan noble. Three of the five were embroidered, but lightly, and she did not complain. Too late to have it picked out, in any case. Tamura asked no more questions than Mistress Dormila had. One deferred to one's seamstress, but in the end she was a seamstress. And, too, seamstresses had their own sense of discretion, or they did not remain in business long. Before leaving, Moiraine tucked her great serpent ring into her belt pouch. Her hand felt oddly naked without it. Her finger itched for the small circle of gold, but too many in Tarvalin knew what it meant. For now, she truly must hide. With her small entourage, she progressed northward, making stops that filled the chest on the porter's shoulder poles with the needful things she could not have brought out of the tower unnoticed, until at last they reached North Harbor, where the city walls curved out into the river and made a ring near a mile across, broken only by the harbor mouth. Wooden-roofed docks lined the inside of that huge ring and moored river ships in every size. A few words with the dock mistress, a heavy-set graying woman with a harassed expression, gained her directions to the Blue Wing, a two-masted vessel. Blue Wing was not the largest vessel at the docks, but it was scheduled to sail within the hour. Soon enough, Arrow had been hoisted aboard by a long wooden boom with straps beneath her belly and secured on deck. The porters had been paid off, the footmen sent away with a silver mark each in thanks, and her trunk made snug in a small quarter-deck cabin. Still, she would be spending more time than she would like in that cabin, so she remained on deck scratching Arrow's nose while the river ship was untied and pushed off, and the long sweeps pushed out to maneuver Blue Wing across the harbor like some immense water bug. That was why she saw the dock mistress pointing to Blue Wing and talking to a man who held his dark cloak around him tightly while he stared at the vessel. Immediately she embraced Sidar, and everything became clearer in her sight, sharper. The effect was not so good as a fine looking-glass, yet she could make out the man's face, peering avidly from his hood. Mistress Dormila's description had been exact. He was not pretty, but good-looking despite the scar at the corner of his left eye, and he was very tall for a Kyrian, close to 2 paces. But how had he found her here, and why had he been searching? She could not think of a pleasant answer to either question, least of all the second. For someone who wanted to stop the Hall's scheme, someone who wanted another house than Domodred on the Sun Throne, the easiest way would be the death of the Hall's candidate. Fixing the fellow's face in memory, she let the power drain away. Another reason to take care, it appeared. He knew the vessel she traveled by, and likely every stop intended between here and the borderlands. That had seemed the best place to begin, far from Kyrian and easily reached by the river. "Is Blue Wing a fast ship, Captain Carney?" she asked. The captain, a wide, sun-dark man with narrow mustaches waxed to spikes, stopped shouting orders and put on a semblance of a respectful smile. He had been quite pleased to take a noble woman's gold for herself and a horse.
"The fastest on the river, to be sure, my lady," he said, and returned to shouting at his crew.
He already had half the gold, and only needed to show respect enough to ensure he got the rest. Any captain might have said the same of his vessel, but when the wind caught the triangular sails, Blue Wing leaped like its namesake, all but flying out of the harbor mouth. At that moment, Moiraine passed into disobedience to the Ammerlin seat. Oh, Ciaran surely would have seen it from the instant she left the tower, but intention was not action.
Whatever penance the woman set likely would combine labor, deprivation, mortification of the flesh, and mortification of the spirit, on top of which she almost certainly had an assassin trailing her. Her knees should have been shaking in fear of Sierran, if not Master Gorthanas. But as Tarvalin and the tower began shrinking behind her, all she felt was a great burst of freedom and excitement. They could not put her on the Sun Throne now. By the time the hall found her, another would be secure in it, and she was off to find the boy child. She was off on an adventure as grand as any ever undertaken by an Aes Sedai.